Well, thanks everybody for coming this morning. I'm not going to talk specifically about hurricanes, although Lord knows we have enough worries about them in Florida, but about the work that we've been doing over the past, I hate to admit it, but about 9 years in microbial source tracking, the methods that are out there, and the importance of method validation, and some of the studies that are upcoming. And it's always bad to give me more time, but I'll try to keep on track and not be too long-winded. And okay, good, I found the down click. So many of you know that the indicator organism paradigm is meant to be a red flag for fecal pollution in water. So these indicator organisms are generally non-pathogenic, and they're meant to act as a warning signal that fecal pollution has contaminated the water and that there's a much higher risk of associated pathogens than there would be in the absence of that fecal contamination. And so we have, this is actually from New Zealand, we have across throughout the world, and of course the U.S. and Canada and New Zealand and many, many other places, we use these indicator organisms as red flags or signal for fecal contamination. But I like to call them pink flags because really they are not perfect indicators of the increased risk of pathogens or the increased risk to human health. And there's a lot of reasons for the disconnect between indicator organism concentrations and the risk of pathogens and associated risk of gastroenteritis and other possible diseases. The ecology and survival characteristics of the indicator organisms have to reflect the ecology and survival characteristics of a whole gamut of pathogens, including protozoa, viruses, and many different kinds of bacteria. And so we have questions of, and which we'll talk about more today, questions of transport characteristics, questions of survival, questions of how do disinfectants, for example, affect these organisms, questions about how do environmental insults like ultraviolet radiation affect them, do they attach to particles or not. So again, a really complex series of relationships that we should be taking into account, but that in practice we've really tried to make this paradigm very simple, and it's not. And then another major source of disconnect between the indicator organisms and the pathogens is that the sources of these indicator bacteria, whether we use fecal coliforms as indicators or E. coli or enterococci, their sources vary from very high-risk sources, such as sewage, for example. So here's a little sewage spill over here, to animals that constitute a definite risk. For example, we know that cattle carry E. coli 015787 and Cryptosporidium. And then we have those sources that really constitute a relatively unknown risk, like wildlife, for example, like birds and pets. And then there's also indicator organisms that survive long-term in sediments and in soils and get delivered to surface waters by stormwater. Here's some nice stormwater flowing in Florida. And so we really don't know a lot at all about the risks entailed by many of these sources. And we would certainly, for many, many purposes, would like to know what is the source of these indicator bacteria. So we need to know this, again, for risk assessment. Indeed, if we know that there are high-risk sources present in the or that are contaminating beach waters, this is Avalon Beach in California, then we can be quite certain that there's an elevated risk to human health. Best management practices and remediation. You really cannot fix a problem or decide on better ways to manage fecal inputs if you don't know what the source is. And of course, the total maximum daily load programs that are mandated by the EPA are dependent on knowledge of the source, and in fact, that is a criterion for TMDL creation. So we have definitely need for knowledge of sources, and so that's where microbial source tracking comes in, with questions of what types of animals are contributing to these increased concentrations of indicator bacteria, which in turn, may constitute an increased risk to human health. So many of you are familiar, or maybe some of you certainly are familiar with microbial source tracking, but I wanted to give you just a brief overview of the main dichotomy of the types of methods that have evolved over the last, and I would say from 1996 to 2007, a little more than 10 years in microbial source tracking. So we really started out using what we call the library-dependent methods, and this really was initiated with Bruce Wiggins' paper in 1996 in Applied Environmental Microbiology. So the idea with the library-dependent methods is that one collects fecal material from various animals that might impact a water body. And so here's some little, this is bird feces, and we have dog feces and sewage and cattle feces. One then isolates indicator bacteria from this fecal material, and depending on one's theoretical framework, depending on the indicator organisms used in a particular state or area, depending on whether one is investigating saltwater versus freshwater, that might all influence your choice of indicator bacteria. In fact, when I was doing library-dependent methods, we consistently found that the enterococci are better indicators of source within the library-dependent framework than E. coli is. But again, you may be working in, one may be working in a state, for example, that uses E. coli as the indicator, and perhaps the regulators aren't really interested in what the sources of enterococci are. Again, you have, that's something that one has to gauge as you develop studies. But at any rate, so one would isolate the indicator bacteria from the feces of the various animals that might impact the watershed, and then one would type these indicator bacteria. Now, typing could be by a phenotypic method. In the beginning, Bruce Wiggins used antibiotic resistance analysis, as we did in our early papers. One could use genotypic typing methods. In this case, were these gels, sorry when I hesitate, I'm trying to get this cursor to work. These gels are box PCR patterns. It's just a form of rep PCR. And these patterns are quite reproducible. You can see that you get a large variety of bands produced, and we can get very, very high diversity of organisms from, example, a water body using this box PCR method. So once one has made the library then basically of indicator bacteria that's isolated from these various fecal sources, then one would go into whatever water system catchment, or in Florida we call these WBIDs, which stands for water body IDs. But when we go out and sample the surface water, and that's actually, come on cursor, my mouse doesn't want to behave. That's actually me there sampling in a little stream. One would sample the waters and go really back through the same round and isolate indicator bacteria, type them, but then one queries the database to say, based on the types that we've isolated from the water, what patterns do they match or are they closest to from the library? And I'll talk a little bit about some of the caveats associated with that, with those methods in a minute. So contrast this this strategy of library-dependent microbial source tracking with library-independent microbial source tracking. Here again, we need to assess the various types of animals that might contribute to fecal pollution in the watershed, and then we would, in this case then, we are using particular bacteria and the genes associated with them, the gene or genes that are associated with them, that are specific to a certain host type. And so the use of library-independent methods obviously depends on one knowing something about the what we call source-associated or source-specific bacteria or markers that are found in these feces. And there have been many methods developed for library-independent microbial source tracking methods that, again, search for source-specific markers that are found in the feces, and this is generally done by polymerase chain reaction, by PCR. And we're using many of those methods now in our lab. I'll tell you about a few of them that we currently use. So if you think that this type of approach looks much simpler than this type of approach, you're right in many ways, although we do have many caveats and validation steps associated with the library independent methods as well as with the library dependent methods. So this is a graph that shows over here, a graph that shows basically shows the accuracy of library dependent methods at predicting the source of indicator bacteria isolated from various fecal types. And this is actually a graph that Don Steckel and I put together from compiled data from all the microbial source tracking studies that we could find over the last 10 years or so. And these are, again, these are library-dependent methods, and what you see is that in the early studies, we have generally quite high accuracy of these libraries. It looks like they're quite predictive of source. But if you look down here, these are the libraries. This represents the studies where the libraries were actually queried using patterns of isolates that were obtained from outside the fecal samples that constituted that particular library. So I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But keep in mind that many of the early microbial source tracking studies were founded on libraries that were incompletely validated. And I have to certainly admit to being one of those people who published some results from libraries that were minimally externally validated. We try and do a much better job of that now. It's kind of a live and learn thing as you're involved in developing these methods and utilizing them. So the library-dependent methods then are, in theory, able to determine the percentage of isolates that are assigned to each source category. Source category meaning, for example, cattle, humans, dogs, birds, or perhaps pets, wildlife, and humans. And so in that way, then, one might be able to get a semi-quantitative or proportional contribution of sources to a water body. For example, one might say, well, when we sampled these water bodies, our libraries predict that 30% of the isolates come from cattle, and 60% of them come from humans, and 10% of them come from birds, for example. But there are a lot of validation steps and caveats associated with those sorts of assessments. One has to determine that you have representatively sampled the many different biological compartments and abiotic compartments that are so crucial to actually being able to accurately do library-dependent analyses. And so representative sampling becomes very expensive and rather difficult to do, because you have to sample or get a representative sample of the host species that are impacting the watershed, and then a representative sample within their fecal and sewage samples. And perhaps even more difficult in many ways is making sure that you have representative samples from the water. For example, if we go out into the Hillsborough River upstream, which is it's somewhat impacted, but not terribly, mostly by light agriculture and, you know, folks with septic systems and a little bit of runoff. If we go into the Hillsborough River and we sample E. coli and we start typing the E. coli in a 100-mil sample by box PCR, the rarefaction curve or the species accumulation curve looks like this. It keeps going up and up and up and up and up. We get, the more we sample, the more isolates that we type from that library, from that sample, we get more and more and more and more and more types, illustrating that the diversity of E. coli is just incredible in these, in just, again, a minimally contaminated water body. And if you go into sewage or something like that, then it's even worse. I mean, you're literally going to have to sample hundreds of isolates before you can determine that you have a representative sample. So this becomes very difficult and very expensive. And another thing that we found out over time is that it's really necessary to what we call decloning the library at the sample level. And so if you sample, for example, the feces of one cow, and you come up with, let's say, seven different E. coli types, but out of the, but you type 20, and so out of those 20, 13 have sister clones within that sample. Then you need to pull out the sister clones because you don't want overrepresentation of one type from that one fecal sample. So there's a lot of caveats and technical concerns about building libraries. Geographic range is a great concern. So if I build a library in Tampa, for example, is that going to be useful for determining the source of indicator bacteria in Jacksonville or in Miami or in Alabama or in Virginia? And so we've done quite a bit of work on that and shown that the libraries are quite geographically limited. Temporal variability. If I build a library in 2006, is it going to be useful at all in 2007 or 2008? Can I keep adding isolates to the library and build it bigger and bigger? Do I have to add and then subtract the old ones, or how, you know, do I have to build a new library every time every year, every season? So these are all extremely pressing questions for library-dependent methods. And then we must ascertain the sensitivity and specificity of the methods. I'll talk about exactly what sensitivity and specificity are. But basically, sensitivity would be, can you detect the source or the marker when it should be present, when you know that fecal source is in the water? Specificity is that source or marker, come on, mouse, is that source or marker absent when that source of contamination is not in the water? And so in order to determine sensitivity and specificity, one needs to use samples that are not represented in the library. It's really crucial. Again, the early studies, we would do what's called cross-validation of the libraries, where you would actually use the isolates in the library to determine the accuracy of classification of the library. And as you can see, this gives you quite high accuracy results compared to using external isolates that you've collected from fecal samples that are collected independently of the library. It just makes a huge difference, and it has to be included in validation. So I don't want to give you the idea that library independent methods have no problems or validation issues. Generally, in contrast with the library dependent methods, where again we're looking at trying to determine the percentage of isolates from each source that are contributing to a water body. In library independent methods, generally we're looking for the presence or absence of a marker. We're saying, yes, this source is here, or no, it's not here. Now, with the advent of quantitative PCR methods, we have the potential for being able to do quite a bit more in the realm of trying to ascertain proportions of sources, loading by various sources, for example. But I just wanted to give you the definitions of sensitivity and specificity, because they can be very confusing. I've been in microbial source tracking meetings where people argue about these. So these are actually the statistically based definitions. That sensitivity would be the frequency of marker detection when the source is present. So if I know that I have sewage in a sample, then how frequently do I detect, for example, the human bacteroides example, the human bacteroides marker? That's sensitivity. Specificity is the frequency of non-detect when the source actually is absent. And so we must be able to know that when the source is not present, that we don't pick up our marker. That's specificity. PCR has, for those of you who've used it in environmental samples, you know that it is notoriously subject to inhibition, so one has to run a lot of controls and sometimes do a lot of sample cleanup to make sure that you don't have PCR inhibition by materials like tannic acid. Well, Florida is notorious for tannic acids, for example, in the samples, and other sort of, you know, organic compounds that cause a lack of a PCR reaction when there should be. So, for example, in our case, we'll run a generic bacteroides for all bacteroides in that sample and make sure that is going to come up when it should. And then we're going to have new criteria for understanding the controls that we need to use for quantitative amplification for qPCR methods. Okay, so there's, again, I don't want to give the impression that the use of library independent methods is a easier trivial matter. And so here are some of the capabilities and limitations of the PCR methods that we use for library independent methods. Presence, absence, those assays that are presence, absence, which are the ones that are mostly in use right now, they don't give you any idea, again, of the proportional loading of sources. PCR can detect minute quantities of DNA, so it's very sensitive, but it's also prone to contamination. You really have to be concerned about that in the lab. The other question with this detection of minute quantities of DNA is, well, if I detect that source, does it have any relevance then to the probability of the presence of pathogens? Maybe some of these assays are so sensitive that the markers can be detected at levels that are not relevant to pathogens. PCR detects both viable and non-viable organisms, so this certainly complicates interpretation of the results. And the PCR uses very small sample sizes, and so frequently then we have to concentrate the targets artificially, have to do filtration and other methods. Now, it's true that we have to do that with indicator bacteria anyway, but you need to keep in mind that representative sampling of water bodies, you need to think about how you're going to achieve that using these small sample sizes for PCR. And of course, I already talked about the need for sample purification because of possible inhibitory compounds. So now I'll get into some practical aspects of the studies that we've done and an example study. So in my early days of microbial source tracking, I did a couple of what I'll call remote studies, meaning that, you know, I was asked to build a library and determine sources based on places that I hadn't gone. And I would say to you, never do that. You need to go and you need to walk along these water bodies or boat along them. You need to look at what the potential sources are. It's really, really important to get out there and have a good knowledge of what the water bodies look like, what the areas around them look like, what the land use is, what the infrastructure is, and also to keep going back periodically. The study runs a year or 2 years, keep going back and looking at it. It's really important to have a very firm knowledge of what's happening in the watershed. Use local knowledge. So now in our more recent studies, we've actually had large meetings of folks from agencies. In Florida, it's the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, the Department of Health. Talk to the Departments of Agriculture. When you're out sampling, talk to farmers. Talk to people who just want to come up to you and tell you, like, when they saw noxious stuff floating around in the water. There's always people who want to talk about that. True, half the time it's going to be something that's not very useful, or, you know, maybe they also have seen UFOs lately. But sometimes you'll really get a good hint as to what might be going on in the watershed. And so here's just some examples of the things that we've seen when we're out walking the WBIDs, as we call it. The WBID, again, is a water body ID in Florida. So this is what I call a redneck sewage treatment plant. These are actually PVC poles with sprinkler heads on top of them. And that's their, that's their aeration device. And this was actually leaking out of this retention pond into a ditch and then flowing down into the surface water body that we were sampling. And so, you know, we basically found out about this by tromping along the stream and looking, and we found this and went, oh, eureka, okay. You'll find pipes sometimes they'll be dripping. This is one of our infamous storm pipes that goes into Tampa Bay right next to a very well-attended swimming area. And this is the case study I'm going to show you, but we would find strange stuff there, like there's a tampon applicator on the beach. And so, you know, you go and you look at these things and you don't need microbial source tracking to get the hint that something's wrong, but you do need microbial source tracking to back you up on the science of the thing. So some of the methods that we currently use in our lab are the Bacteroidetes. This is the larger group to which the genus Bacteroides belongs. It's really the correct denotation for the primers that Kate Fields and her group developed. So we use the 16S rRNA, and there's separate PCR tests for human, ruminant, and horse. The horse marker actually is one that was developed by Jorge Santa Domingo and Oren Shanks. And so this is a fecal anaerobe group. They're obligate anaerobes. They tend to co-evolve with their hosts, and so they tend to be fairly good targets for microbial source tracking. We're using the Enterococcus faecium ESP gene. This is ESP stands for enterococcal surface protein. And these are, they're opportunistic pathogens. They're quite a problem in the hospital, and actually the particular strain that we use as a control strain, C68, is a vancomycin-resistant clinical isolate. But again, with these organisms, we're in our lab right now, as we're deploying them, these are presence-absence methods. And the enterococcal surface protein actually is a virulence factor for attachment to the human gut. Then we use human polyomavirus. Now, this is a marker that is interesting because it is a virus, and this one was developed by Shannon McCoy, a graduate student in my lab. So these are, except to immunocompromised people, these viruses are non-pathogenic. It's estimated that about 50% of people in the U.S. and in other countries are infected, and it's shed in urine and in feces. And so one of the things that I like about using this marker is that I hypothesize that its fate and transport would more accurately mimic viral pathogens than the bacterial microbial source tracking indicators. So we have some studies underway, of course, to test that hypothesis that this marker is more indicative, again, of the fate and transport of the viral markers. So here's my case study that I wanted to give you. This is Ben T. Davis Beach in Tampa. It's a it's a really, really heavily attended beach, especially on the weekend. And what you can see, here's our sampling site. So we call this 1, 2, 3, and 4 very unimaginatively. But the sample sites, and this is sort of in the middle of the beach. This is over by a restaurant. And interestingly, this restaurant has a whole network of pipes. It's up on stilts. It has a whole network of pipes that run underneath it, some of which are sewage pipes, and some of which drip sometimes. And so, you know, this is another case of where you go around with a knowledgeable eye and start looking at things, and you start really having some suspicions about what's going on. And there's a big stormwater pipe over here. That's the one that I just showed you on the picture. And but we have a lot of potential sources of contamination, of indicator bacteria contamination. For example, a lot of runoff comes here into a swale, and then that will come right down to the beach. You know, you've got the parking lot here. All this runoff comes off with bird feces and that sort of thing. But there are even other interesting aspects to the contaminants at this particular beach. This is just indicator organism concentrations over time. This actually isn't the whole time period of the study, but this, I had nice graphs of this, so I put them in here. So we have fecal coliforms, E. coli, and enterococci, and you can see that in some months, particularly these are our rainy season, we're getting concentrations of fecal coliforms of 10 to the 5th per 100 mil, and E. coli close to that, enterococci at close to 10 to the 4th per 100 mil. So these are screaming samples where we know that something is going on at these sites. And in this case, this is the beach right here. This picture's a little small, but these are the portalettes, and this is the beach right next to it. And I don't know if you know how portalettes are clean, but they kind of pick them up and dump them out, and then they hose them down. It's like, well, it's not the most sanitary practice in the universe. I have a picture later on that'll illustrate that quite clearly. But this, then the colored squares here are detection of our markers, and so quite consistently we were getting detection of the ESP, the enterococcal surface protein marker, and the human polyomavirus marker, which are again specific for human contamination. Another site, again, this is the what we call the Crabby Bill's storm pipe, because this is Crabby Bill's restaurant back here, and so consistently then we would also get very high numbers at the storm pipe, although interestingly they didn't always coincide with the portalette numbers, and I'll show you why I think that's the case in just a second. And also consistent detection of the markers. We actually had detection of the markers over here. This is actually kind of incomplete data, I apologize for that, but these graphs were actually made at a time when that sampling wasn't finished, so we did get detection of the markers over here. So we had the participation of a very helpful person named Byron Bartlett, and he works at the Hillsborough Environmental Protection Commission. And he's like the bulldog of sewage contamination. If he suspects contamination anywhere, he's on it. And so when we told him about what we were finding down at the beach, he started tromping around, and he did some dye tests. And he did a dye test at a lift station that connects a hotel to some of the stormwater it was supposed to connect the hotel to the forced sewage main, but what it was actually doing was connecting the hotel and the lift station to a stormwater outfall, and that's the dye test that shows you the results there. The city came in and fixed that problem, and our bacterial counts went down a little bit, but not completely. So here's the leaking portlets that I mentioned before, and this is the material that's flowing out onto the beach after they clean. And if you sample this, we have quite high bacterial numbers, and so they're just going right out onto the beach. So we had the portlets moved to the other side of the parking lot, and the indicator bacteria numbers got better, and the hits over here at site one, which is where the porta potties were, those went down, but we were still having hits to human contamination in high numbers over here at the storm pipe. So we had the whole thing scoped, we had it, had it camered, and they couldn't find anything except sludge about literally that thick in this storm pipe. So there's this heavy, heavy layer of, I won't say, not necessarily sludge, but sediment. Sand mixed with, whatever detritus washes in and out of there, but just a heavy amount. Now, this is very tidally influenced. And so, we talked to the stormwater people and the sewage people, and nobody could figure out what could be cross-connected in here. Well, our friend Byron again went tromping around, and he went up and down this ditch, because whenever we sampled at this ditch, we would get hits to the ESP and the human polyomavirus. And what he finally found as he's walking through here one day when it was relatively dry, he stepped in a squelchy spot, and he bent down to smell the squelchy spot, and it smelled just like sewage. So then we sampled it, and there was kajillions of bacteria in there. And so what we are pretty sure of is that what was happening was that the stormwater was carrying this sewage contamination, which the line was found to be broken. It's funny, whenever we send the sewer infrastructure people somewhere, they always find a broken line. I'm like, how many broken things are there in this place? But the sewage, we think, was flowing down here and then was tidally and wave carried actually back into Crabby Bill's storm pipe, where the sediment served as sort of a breeding ground and nice little cesspool in there for the accumulation and perhaps proliferation of the indicator bacteria. Although the high E. coli and fecal coliform numbers do suggest fairly recent contamination, because again, this is fairly saline, and as we know, E. coli and fecal coliforms don't do that well in high saline. So, at any rate, that's been fixed now, and we have seen a huge drop in our percentage of detection of the markers, and we've seen a really good drop in terms of the indicator bacteria. We still do certainly get indicator bacteria that are coming off of here. But anyway, that turned out to be a very successful example of cooperating with local agencies and of just, really following our noses in a sense and going to the various steps of really investigating the possible sources of contamination. So we call microbial source tracking a weight of evidence approach. The current MST methods that we use are really informative. They provide a huge weight of science behind what we're telling people. If we just said, well, the indicator bacteria counts are high, they'd say it's birds or it's stormwater. But if we have these human markers, they go, oh, we need to pay attention. I mean, they start ripping up lines. It's amazing. It's kind of a weird power to have. But luckily, so far, it's all worked out. But we know that these markers are not perfect. For example, we know that the human bacteroides marker cross-reacts and sometimes gives positive with dog feces. We know that the ESP marker from Enterococcus faecium is relatively uncommon in septic system pump-outs and from failing drain fields. It doesn't seem to survive well through septic systems, but we always find it in domestic, sewage from like a lift station or a wastewater treatment plant. The ruminant bacteroides marker detects both contamination from cattle and from deer, because it's not cattle specific, it's ruminant specific. So this can be, you know, this can be an interpretation factor when you're out in a water body. But then you just go and you walk and you look around and you see whether there's cattle in the water and there's cattle feces, etc. I don't care, but 100 cattle are going to contaminate a water body a lot more than two or three deer are, guaranteed. So again, it's using your head, using the weight of evidence approach, and then the use of multiple markers greatly improves confidence in the results. So just real briefly, since I do have a couple of extra minutes, I wanted to tell you about our newly funded EPA Gulf of Mexico grant. And so we in Tampa are collaborating with Joe Lipo's group at University of West Florida and Artie Ellender's group at University of South Florida. Then we have Marilyn Kilgen's group in Louisiana and Joanna Mott's group and George DiGiovanni's group in Texas. And so we are the three primaries who are going to develop and intercalibrate MST methods so that all three labs are using the same method. We all know the sensitivity and specificity of our methods in our waters using the exact same method, and then we'll go on to do round robin testing, including the other labs, and eventually then we'll use the methods in shell fishing and recreational waters along the coast. So that's a 3-year grant, and we're starting out with using the library. We're using all library independent methods, the markers. We're starting out with conventional PCR methods, presence absence, but we're hoping to segue over to quantitative PCR as the study continues, because that's really what the agencies need. It's really what we want to do, is to give a better sense of the proportional loading of these sources of fecal bacteria. So I have to thank my lab crew, obviously. They do all the work, and I like to say they have all the fun, but they don't believe me. And the Hillsborough Environmental Protection Commission published that study that I showed you about. We have funding from the Florida Department of Environmental Protection and from the DOH. And I don't have Byron Bartlett's name here, but I certainly have to thank him, because he obviously did an amazing job being a poop sleuth, as he is proudly called. So if you have any questions, I'll be happy to take them. And here's my email contact in case you would like to get any reprints. We did the Steckel and Harwood. I'll toot our horn and say that I think that's a fairly good critical review, and that was just published in January. So if you want to check that out, that's got a lot of the recommendations that I just showed you. And with that, if it works, I'll take questions. Thanks. Yes.
So it's my understanding, I'm fairly new to source tracking. So if the question is human versus anything else, the molecular markers are good. But if you want to be more, if you would like to separate out dogs, fish, birds, that probably a library dependent method is important. So they haven't developed PCR methods. A group.
So I've been instructed to repeat the question so that we have it for the recording. But the question was, if you want to do human versus not human, then the library independent methods work pretty well. But if you want to discriminate among a large variety of sources, like let's say wild birds versus dogs versus cattle versus humans versus parakeets, then are the library dependent methods better? Because then we can do that sort of proportional representation of sources that I was talking about. And I would say, in theory, definitely, yes, that the library dependent methods would currently work better for that sort of question, except that my experience with libraries is that they don't. They don't really work for proportional loading, because there are so many caveats associated with the representative sampling that I was just talking about. As you build the libraries bigger and bigger, what happens is that you get it's a little bit of a hard concept, but imagine that you have one of our old libraries where you have perhaps 6 different possible sources, and you have 100 patterns from one source and another and another and another, and they make nice tight groups. As you build the libraries bigger and bigger, you get more and more what we call cosmopolitan types that cross over. And then once you get those cosmopolitan types crossing over, then you get a great muddying, whether you're doing statistical testing or simple matching, then you get a great muddying of the source specificity of those particular types. And then you can say, well, we'll take all the types out that cross over, that are cosmopolitan, that are cross-reactive between species. But the problem is then you start narrowing the pool of the isolates that you can actually type as you pull out the cross-reactive species. And so, again, I worked in library-dependent methods a long time, and there's some situations where they work really well, especially in very small watersheds where you want to ask a very specific question, and I would say over a relatively short time frame. But for large, you know, major watershed-wide questions, I would have my doubts about how well you can actually determine proportional loading. I think you can actually get at some questions, and most of the more successful papers have been the ones where we say, okay, so we're going to say livestock, humans, and other domestic animals, or something like that, and make that sort of split. That tends to work much better. But if you see papers that have proportional loadings from 10 different sources, then be very look hard at the validation of those methods. Yes, I have a question in the back. So the question was, how do you foresee doing proportional loading with qPCR when the markers, I guess, when not everybody would carry the marker? Is that what you're thinking? I mean, that's a big question, and we need to determine if we can actually do proportional loading. Many of the markers that we've found are quite, and actually one of our criteria for a successful microbial source tracking marker is that it's widely distributed in the population. So I think that if we have markers that are widely distributed and we have at least markers that represent the major contributors of contamination in that area, I think that I don't think it's ever going to provide us with hard quantitative numbers, but I think it will provide us at least with semi-quantitative numbers and proportional loading. But that brings up an observation or a consideration that we need to think about with library independent methods, and that is that we need to develop, and this is an ongoing process of developing more markers. For example, when I've done some work in New Zealand, and they really have a huge need for a marker for seals. Okay, we don't really need that in Tampa. Could maybe use it in California, but so different places have needs for different markers, and those need to be developed. And again, people are working on that. Some places, areas in Canada, for example, and other northeastern places really need markers for geese because they can be a huge problem. And so that's an ongoing scientific challenge, is to develop good markers that we can validate for all these different possible sources. And you don't have to use every marker that's available for every watershed, but you would pick the ones that are applicable to your watershed. And then you might use an outlier marker for a negative control sort of thing. Anybody else? Yes. So the question was, have we seen any policy changes or a sort of a payment assignment for pollution from these projects? I guess the closest that I can come is the cities having to clean up their infrastructure. We've certainly seen that. And I'm working in a number of cases in areas where that sort of, okay, the marker's here, now you need to clean this up, is underway, but it hasn't actually happened yet, so we'll see. I think the jury, so to speak, is still out on whether those policy decisions are going to take place. But I think as the MST gets more sophisticated and the results become better and better supported, then I think that's definitely going to happen. I think there was a question over, yeah.
Source tracking. How effective was that versus using the whole?
So using viruses for microbial source tracking?
Correct.
And you're saying how effective is that versus using the host?
Yes.
So do you mean genes from the host, for example?
No, yes.
I think I understand your question. There's some microbial source tracking methods that use genes from the host, for example, mitochondrial DNA, and that has been published in several papers, and I think that that could be a valuable addition to the toolbox. Of course, one of the issues with using something like a host gene like mitochondrial DNA that's ubiquitous and would be shed in the skin is that if you have bathers at a beach and they're shedding, obviously, epidermal cells, then how problematic is that going to be? And I don't think the studies have been done to really answer that question. But I think that it's going to be a neat marker to add into the toolbox. I think the importance of the viruses is that, you know, we know that over 50% of the gastroenteritis that's caused by or that's associated with recreational water use, or at least we estimate that over 50% of it is caused by viruses. And so if you have a viral marker, then I think that, that has the potential to better reflect the fate of viruses that get into the water. I am one of the people who does not, who doesn't think that using pathogenic viruses is going to be terribly useful, just because such a small proportion of the population is infected with pathogenic viruses. So that's why I like the human polyomavirus marker, because there's such a high percentage of humans that are infected with it and shed it. So you're not looking for a rare target. And I personally have always been an advocate of not using rare targets as microbial source tracking markers, because it's as bad as looking for a pathogen, which we all know is really hard to do.
Thank you.
All right, thanks everybody.